Hello and welcome to the Europeans, which I think we have to start for the second week running by talking about the weather, which is very British and cliched of us. Are you enjoying the weirdly warm weather, Katie?
Oh my God, 2021. All it took was 2 days of sunshine for me to forgive everything that has been thrown at us. It's been glorious here in Paris. And it's funny you talk about like this British obsession with talking about the weather, because it feels like French people have now become British and that we all just talk about the weather and it's really nice.
Yeah, actually Dutch people too. They always think it's a Dutch thing. Maybe just everyone talks about the weather. I feel like I've said this before.
So has the ice melted in Amsterdam finally?
Yeah, it's so weird because literally like just over a week ago when we were recording, it was minus 10 here and it's now 16 or 17 degrees, which is kind of fun, but I feel like it's dangerous because I'm worried that people are going to be saying like climate change isn't so bad, forgetting for a moment that like Amsterdam and the most of the Netherlands is going to be underwater for our grandchildren.
I don't want to think about climate change. I just want to think about the fact that it's felt really good over the last couple of days just to sit in the sun and soak it up. And yeah, it just feels like we collectively needed that sunshine because of everything else that's going on. So thank you, weather gods.
This probably feels very triggering. I know we have a few listeners in Texas who have had like an awful time. So I hope you're all doing okay there.
That's very true.
Let's stop talking about the weather and talk about what's coming up later on in the show.
Yeah, what is coming up in this week's show?
We have an interview with one of the most interesting writers and thinkers about Europe alive today, I think. Professor Timothy Garton Ash will be joining us to talk about a project he set up at the University of Oxford that is collecting the stories and opinions of thousands of Europeans through a series of interviews and opinion polls. He'll be joining us later on in the show to talk about Europe's stories. And of course, while we had him here, we couldn't help but ask him about a few of the other big challenges facing Europe. That's coming up in a bit, but first you've got to listen to me and Katie rabbit on about news from Europe that may not have grabbed your attention as much as it should. In everyone's favourite segment. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this rapper, Pablo Hasél, who has been jailed in Spain for 9 months over tweets and lyrics that he wrote glorifying terrorism, at least according to his conviction. And it's become this huge story in Spain, a huge story about freedom of speech and to what extent people should be allowed to say things, even if they're violent or wrong, and how much people should be punished for saying things that are violent or wrong. Hasél has won support from lots of big figures in the Spanish artistic and creative world, people like the film director Pedro Almodóvar and the actor Javier Bardem, who've said that, yeah, Spain should not be locking people up for things that they have tweeted, and especially not for things that they have written in song lyrics. We need to protect people's ability to express themselves, including through rap music. And there have been huge protests this week in support of Hasél, mostly in his home region of Catalonia, but also across Spain. In Barcelona, those protests got really pretty violent. Motorbikes got set on fire. Luxury shops got looted. You really got the impression that this was not just about this rapper getting jailed for his tweets.
What was it that he said that was so bad that gave him this conviction of glorifying terrorism?
So he's actually been convicted twice over the last few years for glorifying terrorism, both in his lyrics, in songs that he put on YouTube, and in tweets that he wrote, which is the thing that he's actually going to prison for. As a rapper, Pablo Hasél is known for having very left-wing views. That is obviously not illegal. But a lot of people would say, and the courts certainly said, that the views expressed in these tweets and these lyrics sometimes went beyond what is legally acceptable, in that he repeatedly praised groups that have carried out violent acts, really violent acts, on behalf of left-wing causes, like Grapo, which is this Marxist anti-fascist group. They're accused of murdering 80 people when they were active between the 70s and the early 2000s, and also ETA, the Basque separatist group. And he also named specific politicians who he said deserved to be targeted in terrorist attacks. So it's not nothing, and I really don't want it to make it sound like he hasn't said anything shocking. He definitely has.
He also got fined for insulting the monarchy, right?
Yeah, and to me that is really the more eyebrow-raising thing. I didn't even know it was illegal to insult the monarchy in Spain. It seems quite archaic. And in fact, quite a lot of European countries have got rid of old laws that made it illegal to say mean things about the king or the head of state. You're still not allowed to do that in Spain. So on top of the prison sentence, Pablo got fined about €25,000 for libelous and insulting comments, including that he called the royal family a mafia and saying that they'd looted the public purse, and also for accusing the police of torturing and killing migrants.
Those things don't sound like something you should be locked up in jail for.
Right, it's a really complicated case. I mean, some of the stuff he said, calling out individual socialist politicians and saying they deserve to be victims of terrorist attacks, like that to me seems pretty extreme. But he's also said this other stuff that you might argue is legitimate criticism of the state to some extent. The whole thing is also quite sensitive because this rapper is Catalan, and limiting criticism of the state, particularly by Catalan people, it brings back all of these memories of repression under the Franco dictatorship. And there's been a lot of people pointing out that, putting aside the case of this rapper for a minute, the existing laws are designed in such a way that you could get in trouble for, yeah, expressing a view which might be considered legitimate criticism of the state. And that is a bit worrying. And there's been several controversial cases in Spain in recent years where people have asked themselves, like, should this really be punishable with a jail sentence? Things like this woman who got convicted for tweeting a joke about a terrorist attack that happened back in the 70s. And this woman who got fined for carrying a giant vagina down the street in the style of a religious procession. She got fined for offending religious sentiment. And it's these kind of cases that have made people think, really? Like, should all of this stuff be punished as harshly as we're punishing it? And to be fair to the Spanish government, when this all blew up about a week ago, they did announce that they were going to reform the free speech laws. It's not really clear what those reforms are going to look like, but they have said, okay, people shouldn't be going to prison for what you might call crimes of expression.
But those reforms are going to be too late for this rapper, right? He's already in prison.
Yeah, Pablo did not go willingly to prison last week. He barricaded himself inside the University of Lleida, which is his hometown in Catalonia, and he got dragged out by police. And that has kicked off night after night of protests, particularly in Barcelona, the Catalan capital, but also other cities in Spain. And it got pretty violent. There have been some really intense clashes with police. One woman lost an eye after she got shot by police with a foam bullet. And as with a lot of protests, you know, it's a minority of people who've turned violent. A lot of people just came out to make themselves heard peacefully.
Are these protests just about this case, or are they about other stuff?
Yeah, it's been quite interesting listening to interviews with some of the protesters. It really feels like this case is like a spark for all of this anger that is pouring out about the general situation that young people are facing right now. It is mostly young people who've taken to the streets. And when you listen to them, they are so frustrated about the situation facing young people in Spain right now. There are no jobs. Spain has the highest youth unemployment in Europe. 40% of young people are unemployed. And a lot of people just feel like their generation is kind of lost. It is an incredibly frustrating time to be young. And it reminded me actually a little bit of the Dutch curfew protests.
Yeah.
Like, I know the demographics of those protests were different and there were lots of far-right people taking part in those riots, but you still get the sense of there being protests ostensibly over one thing as a kind of spark, but actually it feels like a kind of venting of anger over lots of different things. But yeah, a bad week in any case for Pablo Hasél, the rapper, who has had a good week.
It's been a good week for gig workers in Europe after some court rulings and legislative proposals led people to wonder if things might soon start getting better for the many workers who are living with these pretty precarious employment conditions.
So I think everyone sort of knows what they think they mean by a gig economy worker, but can we just sort of set it down? Like, what is it that we're talking about here?
Most of the time when people are talking about gig workers or the gig economy, they are talking about people who work as freelancers for tech companies like Uber, Deliveroo, or Glovo, which is a startup from Barcelona. They are the gig workers most often in the news right now. But of course, all freelancers could be seen as gig workers too. And the term gig stems from my industry, the music industry, where people would go from musical gig to musical gig performing. But the good news for gig workers this week that I want to talk about is that first group of workers, the online platform workers who enter into formal agreements with an on-demand company like Uber, who get paid for the minutes that they are driving or delivering something for a customer, but don't get paid for the minutes that they are like sitting in their car or on their bike waiting to find that passenger. a group of people who are often referred to as like the bogus self-employed, and many of them are actually only working for one client.
I think everyone kind of knows by now how precarious things can be for people who work for these companies. But just to kind of poke the hornet's nest, there are some people who quite like the flexibility of it, right?
Yeah, some people do like that flexibility, and they like being able to make their own schedule, which means they can, I don't know, look after their children where necessary, or
make podcasts.
Or with some of these non-delivery online jobs, they can work from wherever, even like from the beach. And I think that's probably very nice for some people. And on the surface of it, that could sound quite appealing. And it even is sometimes. But according to Sarah Kessler, who wrote this book Gigged, about the gig working culture, it's often the people with the most money and the best education who are able to survive better and use this flexibility to their advantage. And for many, many people, the flexibility also means an absence of the social safety nets, which a normal contracted job gives you. And of course, the psychological pressure that goes along with all of that.
But you said it was like a good week for gig workers, right? So why is it a good week?
Yeah, there have been a few pieces of good news that I noticed this week that seem to suggest that the tide might be turning for gig workers, and that at least some European courts and in some cases governments are working to try and make things better for these vulnerable workers. It's an enormous topic with so many different opinions and rulings, so apologies for not covering everything, but let's go with some of the news from this week. And let's start with the ruling in the UK Supreme Court last week, the final court of appeal, where it was decided that a small group of drivers who've been battling with Uber since 2016 were indeed workers and not self-employed. This was great news for the now former Uber drivers who began this case, but it could also potentially set a precedent for future court cases or tribunals, which could eventually lead to Uber drivers being given guaranteed minimum wage in the UK.
Which sounds amazing, because when you think about how, I'm just imagining Uber drivers driving around at the moment, like you're driving around looking for passengers who are really thin on the ground. And you're also having to like pay for your petrol as you're doing that. Like the hourly wage in the current situation must be crazy low often.
Yeah, and it's really difficult because lots of the government support during the pandemic only covers your profits. And obviously the running costs of having a car and keeping it is really high. So it's left some Uber drivers in real difficulty. So the court decided that the drivers were in a position of subordination to Uber. That was because Uber was setting the fares and they set the contract terms with no negotiation. Uber monitors drivers' service through this like star rating system and can terminate the relationship at any time in the UK immediately.
I mean, all of that does sound a lot like you are working just for a company, right? If you can't even set the prices and that kind of thing. What does this mean for Uber as a company? Like, this is effectively like upending their entire model, isn't it? Like, can they even carry on like this in the UK?
It could have wider implications for Uber and for the gig economy, but it won't happen immediately because of complicated things about how like tribunals and the working market works in the UK. So yeah, it might be slow progress. But in the same week, there was a ruling in the Netherlands, and the Amsterdam Appeals Court ruled in favour of a trade union who have been arguing that delivery workers for Deliveroo, which is a food delivery service, are also pseudo-freelancers. Deliveroo are going to appeal this ruling to the Dutch Supreme Court. But if the appeals court ruling holds, delivery workers would now be able to claim formal contracts, including sick pay and holiday pay.
Brilliant.
Yeah, big news. And Deliveroo responded to the statement with their usual argument about flexibility, claiming that drivers would no longer be able to decide how long and when they work, and that's bad. But yeah, as I said, it's a complex issue and a lot of people are in a very precarious position. The final bit of news I wanted to talk about this week was in Spain, where Yolanda Díaz, who's the Minister of Labour and Social Economy, started sharing a draft law on Monday that would lead to the presumption of employment for delivery workers. It's still an early stage for this bill and things could be watered down even this week, but it would mean big changes for Spanish gig workers. And what was quite interesting is in Spain, there was quite a strong pushback from a professional association of autonomous riders who actually said they wanted to remain autonomous. And Yeah, it just highlights how complex the issue is. There will always be some people for whom flexibility is the most important thing.
So are all of the online gig economy type platforms, are they all pushing back against this? It sounds like they might have an interest in doing that, but is it kind of the same thing across the board?
Yeah, well, mainly the online platforms do push back, although they all claim to be trying to improve conditions for their drivers and riders. There is one company, Just Eat, a delivery tech company based in the Netherlands but working internationally, and they are moving towards only employing their workers. And their CEO wrote a letter in the Financial Times last week celebrating the turning of the tide for gig workers.
The EU in general is quite big on like EU-wide workers regulation. Is there any EU-wide regulation on this or not?
This seems to be on its way. The European Commission will be setting out its own recommendations later this year. And there is much lobbying happening in Brussels right now.
Surprise, surprise.
One of the interesting things that Sarah Kessley suggests, who's this specialist in the field I mentioned earlier, is that if everyone had better access to social safety nets from the state, regardless of their job status, then there wouldn't be such a difference in reality between people who were employed and people in a more precarious form of self-employment. I found that quite an interesting argument that maybe we just need to completely turn our systems upside down. But as I said, the gig working arguments are way broader than just being about these online platforms. And there is a much bigger conversation to be had about most industries, mine and yours too, Katie. Freelance journos and musicians have struggled a lot recently. And yeah, things need to get better across the board.
I just want to be paid on time for the money I am owed, please. That would be nice.
Yeah. That would be very nice. But for now, there have been some small but significant steps in the direction of better protection for gig workers.
Yay! This podcast is a proudly independent operation. It is also a very small operation, run mostly out of my bedroom and in the space under Dominic's stairs. So we are always over the moon when we get an email pinging into our inbox saying that we have a new supporter, because it means that we can carry on doing this for that little bit longer. And this week we have some lovely people to thank: Eva Genova, Liz Schwelger, Carl Cross, Courtney, and longtime supporter Kyle De Silva, who has decided to increase the amount that he's chipping in every month to help us out, which is also incredibly nice. Thank you so much, all of you.
Yeah, thank you so much. You can all head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. You'll find the link in our show notes if I didn't pronounce it very well. And you can get a range of different things, a voicemail from us, a postcard from us, or you could just join our Facebook group if you go for the lowest level, which is a really nice place to be. So please come and join us.
It's time for our interview with Professor Timothy Garton Ash. He's the first guest we've had in ages, Dominic, where it feels like we were definitely supposed to call him Professor. Like, I felt a little bit in awe of him. We haven't had such a distinguished guest since Mr. Ambassador.
It's true. I have some difficulty using those formal terms. I always really push back against hierarchy.
You didn't want to call him, like, Timmy.
I think I just managed not to refer to him at all. Timmy baby.
Anyway, Professor Timothy Garton Ash is a very distinguished British historian of contemporary Europe. He became really well known during the Cold War and was in fact a student in East Berlin, when East Berlin still existed, a period during which he was under surveillance by the Stasi. They suspected he was a spy. He says he wasn't. In his current role as Professor of European Studies at the University of Oxford, he is spearheading a new-ish project, which we recently heard about and thought was really interesting. It's called Europe Stories, and it's about trying to figure out what Europeans want the EU to be and what they want it to actually do over the next decade. These are questions that we are also really interested in, and we were really curious about what his team have found out so far. So we rang up Professor Garton Ash. I am definitely too scared to just call him Timothy. We rang him up for a pretty wide-ranging chat about where he thinks Europe is headed, and I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Your team at the University of Oxford, which sits on an island that is no longer in the EU, but is still in Europe, why did you think this project was necessary, and what are you hoping to learn from it?
I think there's quite a strong feeling that Europe has lost the plot, that for decades it knew what it was about. It was about securing peace in Europe, and then it was about enlarging and bringing in the new democracies of Eastern Europe. What's it really for now? So this is a fantastic project, mainly run by young Europeans, I mean, our graduate students, which is asking, what do we actually want Europe to do by 2030? What are the most important things?
Do you feel that we are missing a European narrative? And are you hoping to create a unified European narrative from this project?
The great thing about Europe, of course, is that it's so diverse and we speak all these different languages and live in all these different ways. The trick is to find the unity and diversity. So the image we use is going from cacophony to polyphony, from a complete chaos of noise to one in which there are some clear themes emerging. And then we hope that European leaders will pick up these dominant themes and actually act on them. I don't think that's happening very much at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the data from the surveys that you've already done as part of this project, it points to a lot of tangible things about the EU that people really appreciate and think are good. Things like the freedom to travel when we're not in a pandemic, the freedom to work in different countries, the ability to use your mobile phone on holiday without paying massive fees. So why does the EU struggle so much to get people excited about it? Like, it still feels like if you're enthusiastic about the EU, you're maybe kind of a bit of a nerd. Why is that?
The place I've seen most European flags waved is in the Great Square, the Maidan in Kiev during the Orange Revolution. Mm-hmm. Then in Trafalgar Square, in the great protests against Brexit. So it's the people who are outside and want to be in, or being pushed out by their compatriots, as happening with Brexit, but still passionately want to be in, who care most about it. For my generation and people older than me, Europe was a project. It was about going to somewhere better in the future. And in a sense, now it's about defending what's been achieved rather than some great project for the future. So in a sense, that's the problem. And by the way, a really interesting finding in our polling was that nearly three quarters of all Europeans asked said the EU wouldn't be worth having if we didn't have freedom of movement. That's an amazing but also a concerning finding.
I can't help noticing, and it's not a criticism, it's an observation, that the kind of people interviewed on the Europe Stories website so far are mostly people that work in kind of professional white-collar jobs. They often speak very good English. They traveled a lot. They've made use of these freedoms to work and travel abroad. They seem kind of cosmopolitan, I guess. How do we make a Europe that feels like it's for everyone and not just for people from those perhaps more privileged demographics?
I mean, that's such a great question because, of course, in almost every European country now, you have the two halves of the society that's, you know, gone to university, typically lives in cities, speaks a couple of languages, loves traveling all around Europe, is metropolitan, cosmopolitan, the kind of people who volunteer to come on and talk about Europe, perhaps people like many of your listeners, and the other half of the society, which maybe doesn't have higher education, lives maybe in the countryside or small towns, and feels in many ways they've got a raw deal from Europe. For example, freedom of movement, they may feel, they were told in the Brexit campaign, has lost them their jobs. So that's a huge challenge for leadership. On our project, the way we address that is we have this opinion polling, which is genuinely a representative sample of everybody. And then we have these qualitative interviews where we know it's going to be unrepresentative. They're going to be, we want them to be younger and pro-European. Because the point being, if EU can't even satisfy young pro-European people, then it's got a huge problem. But that leaves the, if you will, the other half. And the big point here is that EU leaders, people in Brussels, are not going to do the trick. It needs national politicians speaking the national languages, knowing, you know, the local circumstances, to go down to the village hall and the village cafe and make the case in their own languages and in their own circumstances. And that's the big thing that's been lacking, not people at the European level making the case for the EU, but people in national and local contexts.
Are you aiming for this project to be heard about by policymakers and by politicians? Or are you also trying to create a kind of large mass movement of people that maybe might work against the growth of Euroscepticism?
I don't know about a mass movement. That's not so easy to do unless you're Greta.
Aim high.
Well, right. But what is clearly unsatisfactory is a European narrative that is generated from above and from the centre out by Brussels. We know that. So we start by bringing together a bunch of young Europeans from all over Europe and going out there. We actually talk to people. And so above all, it's about relaying to European leaders, including national leaders, what young Europeans really care about. And I think some clear elements are now emerging.
What kind of things?
Freedom of movement is absolutely, everybody says this. Jobs and social security, combating climate change is very high on the list. Defending democracy in member states is actually a really important thing. The fact that countries like Hungary and Poland are ceasing to be democracies, and that's really important to a lot of Europeans, more important than the internal democracy of the EU institutions.
Do you think there's anything the EU could be doing to persuade these countries to move back in the direction of liberal democracy that they're not doing already?
Much more than they're doing already. You know, I've been following these countries for 40 years. I accompanied their struggle to emancipate themselves from the Soviet Union and their transitions to democracy. And now the two countries that were leading in the transition to democracy are leading in the other direction, Hungary and Poland. I would say Hungary is no longer a democracy. The shocking thing happening here is that democracy is being eroded while these countries are full member states of the European Union, which is meant to be a community of democracies and the rule of law. And this process is facilitated by billions of euros coming from Brussels, from structural funds, which are distributed by people like Viktor Orban in Hungary and the Law and Justice Party in Poland to consolidate their neo-authoritarian rule. So, you know, it's not that the EU is neutral in this. Another thing they could do is to kick Viktor Orban's party, Fidesz, out of the so-called European People's Party, which is a big grouping of center-right parties with people like Angela Merkel in it, because I think it's a scandal that Fidesz is still part of that group.
We're also bringing in supposedly this new mechanism that will make receiving EU funds is going to be dependent on whether you manage to adhere to basic sort of democratic standards. Do you think that could help to actually rein in Poland and Hungary?
That's going in precisely the right direction. What we need to do is to reconnect the Europe of values and the Europe of money. The trouble is it's been so watered down with compromise after compromise that now it's actually very weak. It only applies to irregularities in the distribution of EU funds, financial irregularities. It actually says explicitly that a breach in the rule of law does not itself justify triggering this mechanism. So as someone rather well said, if you were an honest dictator, you'd have no problem with it.
To finish up, as part of this Europe Stories project, your team are asking everyone the same questions. So I thought we could turn the tables and ask you a few of the same ones.
What a great idea.
So it's going to be a quick fire round. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so what was your formative European moment?
The great strike in the Lenin shipyard in Gdańsk in August 1980 that gave birth to the Solidarity movement and was in many ways the first hole punched in the Berlin Wall.
Oh, it's so annoying because I just want to ask more about that. I'm not allowed. What do you think has been the worst moment in recent European history?
There's rather too much competition, but I think the wars in former Yugoslavia, the fact that at Srebrenica we went all the way back to genocide and the worst horrors that we've seen in the Second World War, and you know, a prosperous free Europe was just next door and we failed to stop it. That's the worst.
And what about the best moment in recent European history?
The best moment has to be the other formative experience of my life, which was the Velvet Revolutions of 1989, which I was lucky enough to witness. culminating, of course, in the totemic moment of the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Can differing European narratives coexist?
They not only can, they must. One thing history teaches us is every attempt to create a monolithic empire in Europe has failed. And so the only way it's going to work is if we have multiple voices working together. And that's what we mean by unity and diversity.
What's the thing you most want the EU to have achieved by 2030?
A common foreign policy. The fact is, geopolitically, we're going into a very dangerous world, which will be dominated by old and new giants, above all China, but also India, Russia, the United States. And if you're to defend your values and your interests in a world of giants, you need to be a giant yourself.
Big thanks to our listener, Lily, for setting up this interview and suggesting Professor Garton Ash as our guest this week. I actually did one of these Europe Stories interviews myself the other day, and it was really fun.
Oh, did you?
I recommend it highly if you fancy answering a few questions on video about your feelings about Europe. It made me think. It takes about 15 minutes, and yeah, it's nice to participate with such an appealing project. We'll put a link in the show notes for instructions on how to join them. What have you been enjoying this week, Katie?
I had quite a screen bingey week. I've got a TV series and a film for you.
Whoa.
Busy week. The TV series is Capitani on Netflix, the first ever police series filmed in the Luxembourgish language, apparently. Thank you very much to Luxemburger and former guest of this podcast, Diego Velasquez, for flagging it up on Twitter. I don't normally go for these sort of dark, Scandi-style police dramas, so I mostly switched on because I was curious to see a series in Luxembourgish, and it's always fun to listen to a language that you understand little bits of. But it's really quite gripping. It's about a teenage girl who was found dead in the woods in this little village, and her twin sister has gone missing. Quite a grim setup. And this high-flying cop is brought in from the big city to solve the crime. But it's really good. I think it's really well told. It's very well acted. Yeah, definitely recommend it. Capitani on Netflix.
I nearly started watching it, but I just don't know if I can watch another show about a girl being kidnapped.
Yeah, it's not really what I need right now. I definitely need like funny things in my life. But it is genuinely good TV. I've realized Netflix is responsible for so much of my international TV viewing during this health crisis that we've been having. So we have them to thank for that.
And I keep thinking about this EU legislation that forced Netflix and other international streaming services to have 30% of their output come from Europe. It's really had an effect that you can notice now.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. The other thing that I watched and loved was the film Mangrove. It's part of this series called Small Axe. Have you seen any of them?
The Steve McQueen films.
Yes, the Steve McQueen films. So it's a series of five films by the director Steve McQueen, and they all follow different characters in the West Indian community in London. They're kind of historical dramas set between the 60s and the 80s. And they're about real events at a time when Black British people were facing horrendous racism in policing and in everyday life, really. Mangrove is about the Mangrove Nine, this group of Black activists who were put on trial for protesting about the way that this West Indian restaurant was being treated by the police. The police basically harassed this restaurant for years and launched raids on it for no reason. And the trial became famous as the first British court case where racism by the police was really acknowledged. And this film, Mangrove, it does such a great job of bringing the injustice of all of that to life. I think it's the best film I've seen this year, actually. It is really beautiful and full of righteous anger. It was supposed to open at the Cannes Film Festival last year. That unfortunately never happened, but you can watch it now on the BBC if you're in the UK, or on Amazon Prime if you are not in the UK, and it's really, really worth watching.
I don't think it's on Amazon Prime in the Netherlands, which really annoys me. I was looking for it, which surprises me as well, because Steve McQueen lives in Amsterdam, so come on.
Get it together, Amazon.
In more ways than one.
More ways than one. What have you been watching or otherwise enjoying this week?
This week I've been absolutely obsessed with an old Eurovision song. Dinga Dong won the Eurovision Song Contest for the Netherlands in 1975. It was performed by a band called Teach In,
okay,
which is one of those like typical English language names written by a Dutch group that doesn't quite make sense. I think it like sounds like it's got a pun in it, but I don't think it does.
What's the pun?
Teach in? I don't know. Like you're teaching?
Oh.
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, it was absolutely what I needed this week. And with the weather improving, with vaccinations increasing, I felt like almost a little bit optimistic for the first time in ages. And I had the song on repeat over the weekend, dancing around the flat, living my 70s Eurovision fantasy. Let's play a little bit of that song.
Oh, this is so summery. Love it. Summer vibes.
Actually, I first started listening to it because I was reminded of it in a roundabout way by RuPaul's Drag Race UK, which, sidebar, is excellent this year in its second season. They hosted the RuRuVision Song Contest 2 weeks ago, and the song the drag queens had to perform was almost certainly inspired by Ding A Dong, albeit loosely. If you've been watching the show, you'll know which song I'm talking about because I'm sure that song will also have been stuck in your head ever since. It's a song that goes bing, bang, bong, ding, dang, dong, sing, sang, song, UK hum. And it actually made its way to number 2 in the UK charts last week.
Did it?
Yeah. I think most people don't realise it's almost certainly inspired by this old Dutch Eurovision song. But
there you are.
I thought I'd share that with the world. RuPaul's Drag Race UK can be seen on World of Wonder around the world or the BBC I play it in the UK. It's worth it. Season one was a bit disappointing, but it's really finding its stride. I'm on hashtag team Bimini.
Good to know. Is Eurovision actually going to happen this year? Do we know?
Yes. They've apparently got various different scenarios depending on what is going to be happening with the old demic at that point.
The demic.
But they've said it is going ahead with a final on 22nd of May.
Yay! Just what we need.
This was that really rare week when I had loads of options for my happy ending and I couldn't work out which one to choose.
So inconvenient for you.
It really is. But yeah, this week I had a plethora to choose from. For example, there was this amazing story of a beautiful 12th century Islamic bathhouse uncovered during a renovation of a tapas bar in Seville.
Oh, yeah.
And sticking in Spain, we're in Spain a lot this week, apparently. There was this lovely story of some toy makers in the east of the country who've been pioneers in making a hugely successful range of dolls with Down syndrome. Dolls which have been getting international praise and winning prizes. But because this is a podcast, I couldn't help but pick the discovery of the world's oldest seashell instrument for this week's happy ending.
This is that, yeah, big horn thing. What is it?
It's a conch shell, which had been sitting around gathering dust, or probably not actually gathering dust, in the Natural History Museum in Toulouse since it had been discovered in 1931. And recently they were doing an inventory of all their objects and researchers became intrigued again by this conch shell. They thought it had been used as a ceremonial drinking cup, but they realized looking more closely that in fact the opening at the end of the shell was not just an opening that had been created accidentally. It was a hole that had been deliberately crafted. And they decided to test it out and invited a French horn player to come and see if they could make any sound out of it. Excitingly, they could. Shall we hear some conch notes? That's how it sounds, yeah.
It's very beautiful.
So yes, that's a C natural, a D natural, and a C sharp.
If you say so.
Pretty amazing that this shell, once home to a sea snail, became a musical instrument, sat in a cave, undiscovered for many thousands of years, sat around again in a museum for nearly 100 years, and now is being played again, and now is being talked about on a podcast. What would these cavemen have thought about a podcast?
We should get a new jingle made out of it.
We definitely should. I think that's a great idea. The researchers were really excited because they also found little red markings inside the shell that match artistic markings on the wall of the cave where it was found.
Ooh.
An amazing piece of artistic continuity. And they are hoping to take the shell back to the cave and have someone try out the instrument in its original acoustic, taking it home for the first time in 18,000 years.
We are taking a break next week. we're not going to be here, listeners, I'm sorry to tell you. And that is because we are going on holiday to the Bahamas.
I wish.
If only that was true or even possible.
Maybe we don't need to go to the Bahamas because the weather's so good here, both in Amsterdam and Paris.
That's true. I'll take 18 degrees Celsius. That'll do. But no, we're not going on holiday. But we are taking a break because we're going to be working on some fancy episodes for later in the year. And we need a little bit of time to take stock. So we will be back in 2 weeks' time. But in the meantime, if you can't bear to be apart from us for that long, don't worry, because you can still find us all over the social medias. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, and on Facebook under the Europeans Podcast.
Thank you to our wonderful editors this week once again, Priyanka Shankar, Andre Popovicu, and Katz Laszlo. Bye, guys.
Adieu.